When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedy-ad-free. That's amazon.com/comedy-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to the fourth Clash of the Titles Fanuary of the Year, the podcast that this January pits two movies with something in common picked by fans of the show and puts them in a fight to the death to see which one comes out victorious. This week, in the red corner, Costner and Connery are cleaning up Chicago. The Chicago Way, as they take on Robert De Niro's skull-crushing Al Capone in 1987's The Untouchables. While in the blue corner, Hanks is in somber mode as he's simultaneously on the run and out for revenge on Daniel Craig and Paul Newman in 2002's Road to Perdition.
What draws my admiration? What is that which gives me joy?
Dave!
Baseball! You follow me? No one! Sunny day, stands are full of fans. What does he have to say? I'm going out there for myself.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
Connor, is there something you would like to say about last night?
I'd like to apologize for what happened. Especially to you. 2 weeks and a month. What can I say?
We lost a good man last night. You think it's funny? Try again.
I'd like to apologize.
So, it's a Prohibition-era punch-up this week, but which film will be victorious? Let's find out. Welcome to Clash of the Titles.
The Kraken.
Hello, Clash Putters. This podcast stinks like a whorehouse at low tide. I'm Alex Zane.
I'm Vicky Crompton.
I'm Chris Tilley.
And welcome to the fourth and final Fanuary special, a month of listener-chosen clashes. But fear not. We continue with your suggested clashes next month as February Fanny is upon us. So, if you do have a clash to suggest, email us at show@clashpod.com with a reason for your suggestion, and we may try and do it. But back to today. Chris, who do we have to thank for this clash?
Chris Bowman, who says, thanks for making Monday mornings brighter. Who knew the drive to work after the weekend could be enjoyable? It's been a brilliant year from your show and can't wait for all the future clashes. And he suggests two movies about Prohibition, plus Costner v. Hanks. Both films to me have a classic feel and timeless look. I must admit I have a super soft spot for The Untouchables, and although I'm not always the biggest Costner fan, I love it. The score, the set pieces, Connery, Garcia, possibly the coolest and slickest character in any gangster film. Road to Perdition is also brilliantly acted and with a similarly big cast. Hanks playing against type, Newman in his last role, Law, Craig, Tucci and more. It's dark and tense. Great movie.
I love that. That's good. That's what we mean when we say give us a reason.
It's lovely, isn't it?
Give us a reason.
Comprehensive.
That was fantastic. And I agree with Chris Bowman. I think I'm not
madly in love with Costner in everything he does, but in this, I think he's fantastic.
Oh, that's interesting. Oh. I don't. Oh. But I normally like him in everything, so wow. He gets a bit of a pass. Do you know what? I was just checking. I don't think I've written the verdict, so I don't think I can decide. So that's fun, isn't
Ooh.
It? Ooh, hooray!
Normally she ruins the Jeopardy.
Yeah. It's extra Jeopardy.
Extra Jeopardy and unprofessionalism. But nevertheless, okay, the clue V gave on last week's show was what again?
Now let me welcome everybody to the Wild Wild West, which is so obvious.
Hey, well, apparently so, because what did you follow up with on Twitter, Chris?
Nout.
Nothing.
Did someone get it?
Yeah.
Fuck you, motherfuckers. You fucking rinsed me. You always do. Fuck you.
So yeah, I think what happened is everyone got the Untouchables.
Yeah.
And then it was just everyone
then
guessing.
It's a short leap.
It was guessing every other gangster movie. Yeah.
Which is fine.
And someone got there.
Yeah.
Well, in fact. So we owe you an apology, Vicky.
Yeah.
About bloody time.
Two people, in fact, got there. The guesses were found bootlegging away on our Twitter, at ClashPod, if you want to give us a follow. We're also on Instagram and TikTok, at ClashPod as well. And if you're in the business for a little extra class completely free of charge, why not check out our YouTube channel? Subscribe on YouTube, Clash of the Titles. So, who won this week? Well, it's congrats to Arden, who did get it white. But this week's winner, with the... I'm turning to Barrymore.
Are you right?
A white! I'm all white. This week's winner with the first correct guess is long-time listener and multiple winner, Andrew Logan. Well done, Andrew. Your prize is to clean up this town the Chicago way. So, connection section. Frank Nitti!
Frank Nitti!
Yes, as I told you both.
Yep.
It's Frank Nitti.
He's very different, isn't he?
He is. Very different.
Yeah, I know which one I prefer.
Yeah, sure.
Do you want to say now?
No Jeopardy.
Right, good. Little test there.
It's a new section.
Tommy Guns.
Oh, yeah.
Chicago.
I mean, there's a lot. It's the same era in the same city. Are you going to go through everything?
I got worried because you said last week you weren't sure whether this was the strongest connection, so I went deep on every bloody obvious thing to make sure this works.
Okay, coats.
Double-breasted coats.
There's the very tragic death of an innocent child in both films. The little girl at the start of Untouchables and the son in Road to Perdition, the other son.
Oof, yeah.
Scenery-chewing performances. I'd argue that both De Niro and Jude Law go big.
Threatening the accountant / bookkeeper.
Mm-hmm. Dodgy Irish accents.
Oh yeah.
I mean, I don't know if Connery's even trying, but the odd word here or there slips through.
I think initially, because he got the part, he's like, I'll definitely do it. And then once he got off that bridge, he's like, so we're done with that now. Yeah. Now I'm Scottish.
It's what Connery did. It's like, you're a Russian submarine captain. For sure I am.
I know.
Of course.
But why couldn't he just
That's Vidania.
From Scotland. I know there's a huge Irish community in that part of the world, but he could have just gone, and I'm Scottish. And that's fine. Everyone would have been like, that's cool.
Sure. And I do think, I think Newman slips in and out in his performance as well. I'm even not sure if he's going for it. I don't know whether, maybe I missed something and it is a really subtle. Maybe
I think it's like a naturalised accent. Right. So I think he leans into it, you know, when he's surrounded by his family, but when he's being more professional, then no.
Okay. Any more?
Jude Law's press guy, and then there's the press guy in the thing.
All right, no more. We're done.
Yeah,
we're done.
Press guy.
There's different characters in both movies.
Tommy guns, gangsters. No one did Prohibition era.
I was going to say, it's the 30s. Prohibition in the 30s.
Yeah. All right, I think that's enough then. So, on Thursday, we're on a road trip to Perdition, which means today... We're touching on The Untouchables. Chris, take us on a journey.
The Untouchables is a film in which Elliot Ness forms a crack team to take down Al Capone. They do this by grabbing his business ledger during a raid on the Canadian border, grabbing his bookmaker during a station shootout, and killing his main man, Frank Nitti, by throwing him off a roof. Ness also tells Capone he's going to take him down during a standoff at his hotel, then celebrates in his face once he gets done for tax evasion, causing Capone to be held back by his mates like Vicky during Last Orders. It's a great film. Only the Canadian raid never happened, the station shootout never happened, Frank Nitti lived for another 12 years, and Ness never met Capone. Still great film! So that's The Untouchables. When did you first see this one, Vicky?
It's a Mark Parsons VHS. Mm. I believe it's a 3-star film from the Halliwell's Guide. So it was on the shelf, he made me watch it, And I've only seen it once, but I have a lot of fondness towards it because it is fun and it's very quite silly. I liked it. So when I was watching it in the week, Mark informed me, which I wanted to just do a little sense check with you. He says he had the Spectrum game, and I didn't believe him because I don't remember it at all.
Yeah, there was a side-scrolling game on the Spectrum. I think the Commodore 64.
So people just used to hide behind barrels a lot. Mm. Yeah, okay. Yeah,
that was every Spectrum game.
It was every movie tie-in game, certainly. Probably made by Ocean.
Robocop. Yeah. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Side-scroll the shit out of that.
Yeah.
I think we need to catalogue the Mark Parsons collection just so we know what's true and what isn't here.
Oh, okay. So you went to catalogue with him.
How many were there?
Oh god, there were loads.
Okay.
There
I remember
loads.
The
book. Okay, so it's believable that all 300 films we've done, 500 films we've done were in there. Alex.
Watched it once when I was a kid, probably about 8 or 9, so shortly after it came onto VHS, remember loving it, never watched it again. This is the second watch. That's it.
Yeah, I was saying, but I was probably about 12. Quite hardcore violent film. For you know, you watched more horror than I did when you were a little kid. This for me was pretty shocking as a child, and then I've seen it a couple of times since. The last time I saw it was about 3 years ago. I thought, oh, it's a good film. If ever I launch a podcast, I'd love to talk about it on there. 3 years in,
I launch. What's this?
I did launch a podcast.
You collaborated on the launch of a podcast.
Well, let's not go down this wormhole because there is a genuine dispute about who came up with the name. And I think Chris genuinely thinks he came up with the name. But
he did.
I'm pretty sure that was me.
Oh, geez, is that what you think?
Do you think it was you?
No, I know it wasn't me. I'm shit with stuff like that. I can hold my hand up.
Clash of the Movie Titles is what I said.
Oh, yeah.
And I was told no. And then a month later, yeah, Clash of the Titles. That's what happened.
Yeah. Is that really what happened?
Yeah.
And then our glorious overlord went, you need to put movie back in the podcast title so people know. And recently we have done just that. So God. Chris wins in the end.
So I completely missed out and I told you so.
Did you not know this?
So annoying. Lovely stuff. Right, so a bit of background on this one. Paramount owned the rights to The Untouchables, the TV show that they'd done in the 1950s. Producer Art Linson developed it. He hired a writer, David Mamet, not a bad going there. Brian De Palma needed a hit. He read Mamet's script. He liked it. We're off to the races. So now this film, it looks like a star-studded cast, but it really wasn't then, because Garcia and Costner were pretty much unknown. Certainly Garcia was. But Brian De Palma spoke to Kevin Costner as he liked him in the film Silverado. Have you ever seen Silverado?
I have not.
It's a good one.
Really?
It's a good one. One to think about for the future. Costner said, no, I ain't interested. So De Palma went to Mel Gibson. And Mel Gibson said, maybe. But then it conflicted with another job called Lethal Weapon. So we lost out on Mel Gibson as Elliot Ness.
Right choice, though, for Mel.
Right choice for Mel. He would have been a good Elliot Ness, though, as well.
Mm-hmm. He was good. I mean, I know he's not good now, but,
but
in
was.
His day.
Yeah.
I watched Signs at the weekend.
Oh, really?
So good. Love him.
The studio said, get Costner, we don't need a star. De Palma said, we do need a star. So he's on that bandwagon. Art Linson pushes for Costner. De Palma speaks to all of Kevin Costner's previous directors. And they all said, this kid's got something. And so Costner read the script that Mamet had written. He liked it. And De Palma said when he spoke to him, he was affected by his sincerity. Which he felt was perfect for Elliot Ness. And I think that does come through. You can see why he was cast. Whether you like the performance or not, he sort of exudes a decency to the point of almost boring.
But that's why I don't... It's not that I don't like Kevin Costner. It's that... I think he does a brilliant job as Elliot Ness because he is like a SWAT, isn't he? Like, he's like ruining the party and ruining the fun. And whether or not that's true of the real Elliot Ness, Kevin Costner embodies that. Like, when they... they print the thing when he does the newspaper thing with the parasols and they're like, haha, you idiot. And he can't take a joke. He puts it up on his board because he's like, I'm burning with this. And it's like, God, you're so annoying. But he plays annoying very well.
But also, I think when you get to later Costner, he was like, I'm going to write it, direct it, produce it, do the theme tune. You can't really escape that sort of ego off camera when you're watching him on camera. But here, he was just a young actor. So you sort of feel there's something more innocent about him.
Yeah.
I think of him as, I compare it to Seinfeld, where I always think of Seinfeld never makes me laugh in that sitcom. Mm. He's the straight man to these three more colourful characters around him. And you need him in the middle of it all, for them to work. And I think that's what's happening here. You need this straight man for these other more interesting people to sort of
that is fair.
Be around him.
Yeah, and also, I mean, when you put De Niro doing what De Niro does in this, you have to have, like you say, someone just a lot smaller in their performance.
Yeah, exactly. They nearly got that in Bob Hoskins. We're getting there. Andy Garcia read for Frank Nitti.
Did he?
They wanted him to play the heavy, but he convinced them to let him read for Stone.
Why? And it's a less substantial role.
Are you kidding?
No, I think he's underused. I think he's amazingly introduced, and then they forget about him.
No.
They do.
No,
because... Apart from the pram
Yeah,
bit.
Exactly. That's yeah, where no, you're right. Throwing the gun. Take him.
It's fucking amazing. But he's sort of missing in the middle. He's set up. He's fit as, obviously. Mm. So, like, why are we not with him much, much more? But he's just forgotten about. He's just there as an accessory in the middle, and then he gets that big thing at
but
the
Frank
end.
But Frank Nitti must have, six words in the whole thing? It's not, and he's
yeah,
a
but
villain.
He's the antagonist. It's cool. Like, he moves the story along.
Sure.
Anyway, that's just my opinion.
Yeah. It's valid.
Thanks.
I see you.
Do you? Yeah. Thank you.
I don't. Connery got interested when he heard David Mamet was writing the script. He liked the idea of playing an old dog teaching a new dog tricks.
Irish, you say?
Not a problem.
I've got that. That's my speciality.
Can't you hear? Because this is what it is.
Let me show you the accent right now. It's hello. I'm Malone.
It's an insane...
Fantastic. Do that on the day.
It's an insane period. In the space of 3 years, he plays a Spaniard, an Irishman, and a Russian. And he doesn't try in any of them. To the point that in Red October, they just remove it in the first minute, don't they? Mm. Everyone speaks in their own language, apart from like one bloke, which I never.
Tim Curry, isn't it?
Is it Tim Curry or Sam Neill? Anyway, it's just bizarre. He's not trying. These are three of his biggest roles at the tail end of his career, and he didn't try in any of them.
I think it is Tim Curry who does the accent because you say
it is,
you say to Tim Curry, you don't have to do an accent. He's like, I'm obviously going to do an accent.
Spice.
That's what I do.
So you've got four different actors playing four different characters, and Costner felt that there was an element of them all playing themselves, with Connery as the leader, him being the stiff, Garcia being a bit hot-headed, and Charles Martin Smith being this sort of unlikely one that shouldn't really be part of this gang.
Mm. But gets really into it.
Yeah.
Just before he dies.
He deserves it.
So for Al Capone, again, the studio said, we don't need a star.
Wow.
Because it's such a big name, and the film title, the character, we can cast anyone in this role that can do it. But they liked Bob Hoskins, and they famously made a deal for Bob Hoskins. But at the same time, De Palma was pushing for De Niro. And I'm going to play this little clip of Bob Hoskins describing what happened next.
I got a phone call from... I got sent the script of The Untouchables. And De Palma said, take a look at Al Capone. And meet me in the bar. So I went to the... it was this bar. And he said... The first thing he said was, well, really, I want De Niro to play this part. I said, oh, great, I'm glad I've come. And he said, but, like, he's a bit difficult to get an answer out of. If he won't do it, would you do it? I said, yeah, if I'm free, yeah. I ain't holding myself open,
Yeah.
So he said, okay. And next thing I know, De Niro's playing the part. I read it in a paper. He got him. Linda and me are sitting there having breakfast one morning. Linda's opening a post. She said, what's this? And it was a check for $200,000.
To you?
To me.
They sent you a letter with $200,000. Who sent it?
It was. He said, thanks for your time, love, Brian. I phoned him up and said, Brian, listen, you got any films you don't want me to be in, babe? I'm not for you. Any day.
Wow.
That's amazing.
That's amazing. I don't know how you made that work.
Is that De Palma's money or is that studio money?
Studio money.
Really?
Yeah, because he signed a contract.
Right, okay.
Yeah, oh, I see. Yeah. So he's basically kind of fired for constructive dismissal.
Yes, but he knew in advance that it was a likelihood, right, so he wasn't upset about it. I mean, he was upset, but it helped. It numbed the pain.
Sure,
But he knew he was going to get that money. It wasn't like, oh my gosh, what a surprise.
But there was issues with De Niro because he wanted a fortune and the studio said no. And they kept saying to De Palma, you've got Bob Hoskins.
You paid for Bob Hoskins.
But De Palma then threatened to walk unless they cast De Niro. And Art Linson sorted it out for him. Said, if you think this is going to make a difference to the film. And you know what? I love Bob Hoskins. He's one of my favourite actors of all time. But it's a better film with De Niro playing Al Capone.
Yeah.
Even though he doesn't really look like him. Too big. And
he's too old.
Because he was obsessed, wasn't he, De Niro, with the shape of his face. He wanted it to be rounder because Capone's face was rounder. And I think I mean, I've only got one memory of Capone, which is like the still from when I went to Alcatraz and he was one of the inmates and you see his face. And then I think there's a similarity there.
Well, they were just worried because when he showed up on set, he was, as Art Linson described it, he was pencil thin and soft-spoken. And I said to Brian, we're fucked. But they shot a lot of the Capone stuff at the end of the shoot. And he put on weight. You know, he's wearing a bodysuit. They filled out his face. Mm. And he filled out his face with pizza, I guess. And job done.
He looks good. He looks like a powerful man.
Yeah, they sorted out his hair. They gave him the scar. And when he does that grin, it's incredibly menacing, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, lovely stuff. So, behind the scenes, De Palma wanted to... Oh, the DP, not De Palma. I've written that down wrong. wanted to shoot it in black and white. Studio said, no, we ain't doing that. No.
But it would would not have watched it. Age 8, no way. Black and white.
Ever.
No, probably still.
It does make total sense, though, because you only ever saw these people in black and white, and The Untouchables originally was in black and white. And so I can see why they were pushing for it.
Yeah, but when you've got Giorgio Armani directing, providing the costumes,
yes.
You're like, you probably want to see those in colour.
Mm. Yeah. They're all dark. they're all black or grey.
Yeah, true.
But as you say, Armani suits all over the place. Everyone looks great.
They look great.
You know, they've managed to get period cars from the time. And it was tricky shooting it around Chicago because there were lots of new high-rises. But it's just, you just feel like you're taken back to a time and a place watching this film, don't you?
Mm.
And as I said, none of it happened.
Mm.
That's it. Can we talk about the film?
I mean, the fact that he wasn't even involved, really, Elliot Ness, in the income tax prosecution. That wasn't even part of his case.
No. I guess that's what Charlie Martin Smith's character is there for, to sort of add that aspect to it, even though he wasn't part of the Untouchables, the guy that did do that. But who cares?
Yeah.
It's a good story.
Exactly. I'd rather a fun story than an accurate story, am I right?
Yeah.
Right, let's get into this one. So, 1930 is the year. It's the time of Al Capone. Doesn't corruption look great?
Mm.
It's just, it's. I think they compared it on one of the documentaries I watched, the guys who made it, to Nazi Germany or Capone being Louis XIV. It's just opulence everywhere you look.
Mm.
It's got that Wolf of Wall Street vibe where, what's his face? The guy who's investigating Jordan, it's like he like goes home on the subway
oh,
and all
yeah,
that.
Yeah,
like
yeah.
Really sort of like he's got nothing, but crime pays.
Yeah.
He's being shaved, Al Capone, and the barber nicks him and everyone's waiting and holds their breath. And it's clever because there's no violence in that scene, but the threat of violence is so palpable that you know you're in the presence of someone really frightening.
Mm.
And he's already giving his... He only speaks in speeches in this film, De Niro. I think he's got maybe 5 or 6 scenes. And every scene, it's a series of speeches. But he talks about, I'm responding to the will of the people. He's a businessman. He gets further with a kind word than a gun.
It's amazing where the press laugh at him. Because you've got this guy who's, like, clearly evil, but he makes people laugh. So he's got that kind of, like, folk hero vibe going on.
But yeah, but why not? Because if you think about... Prohibition lasted a really long time. And was the temperance movement sort of getting their own way. But it wasn't necessarily like a wide sweeping, it wasn't like a democratic thing, like the will of the people. And human beings have, for a very long time, used substances for whatever. And so just because prohibition is a thing doesn't mean everyone suddenly stops drinking. So if you're rich, you will still drink. Mm-hmm. And if you're poor, you'll drink shit stuff and kill yourself. So Al Capone, obviously, is a criminal. But when you criminalise alcohol, then a criminal can rise to the top of society because people still want this stuff. Like, making it illegal doesn't stop people from wanting it. And that folk hero element, you can think that a man like Al Capone, people are never just one thing, Alex. I don't know if I've mentioned that,
you,
but
you have.
Yes, he's a baddie, but also he's got every right to say, I'm just giving the people what they want, because he is.
Yeah.
So.
I mean, I'd totally be on board with him. I'd be like, you've got booze.
I mean, the thing is, obviously, like, in Prohibition, I don't think I would have suddenly been like, well, that's that for me then. Like, I would have found a way of doing it, but I wouldn't have had enough money to, like, drink clean stuff, so I would have been drinking, what did they drink?
I imagine you would have been making moonshine, if I'm honest. I can see. Actually, Mark probably would.
Probably does.
So what's this cocktail? Is it a jet pilot, a margarita? Just drink it.
Just drink. Don't ask any questions.
Man in a white suit, who we later learn is Frank Nitti, blows up a little girl.
Yeah.
Shocking.
Brutal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It feels like the first De Palma doing Hitchcock moment, though, because that's straight out of a Hitchcock thriller. Elliot Ness is reading that headline then, and his wife tells him, now it's time to go to work. And she's got a proud little note for him.
So wait, this, can I ask, Kevin Costner, I always get the timeline confused. He's not a big star, is he, at this point?
No. No, so he's been in films, but he's not a name above the title.
So why is it that the movement of the camera, the direction of this scene is so like, there's a big star here, everyone, and I will not show you his face. You see, is it Patricia Clarkson, his wife, and she's like, oh, it's time, I'm such a brilliant wife, whatever, it's time to go. And Kevin Costner's face is kept away from you, as if they're going to do the reveal in a minute, like, da-da, it's so-and-so.
It's because Elliot Ness is a household name. They're revealing the character. It's like revealing Superman.
Oh, okay. Yeah. All right, fine.
That's what I would say. Kevin Costner's beautiful.
God, he is.
And so you sort of, people know what he looks like, so you're just waiting.
Yeah.
Sitting on the edge of that seat going, show me those eyes.
Show me those baby blues.
Vic, how do we feel about his very boring, very supportive wife, by Patricia Clarkson?
Oh, my God.
Drives me fucking insane.
What did I write down? Best wife ever.
I mean, I don't... It's not... She gets barely anything to say, so let's not sort of put it with that character's door. But later on, it makes me laugh. I don't know if it's meant to make me laugh, where he's like, she's just somewhere talking about kitchen paint or something, and she exists in a world in which paint still matters. And it's like, Jesus Christ. She's your wife. You have a very dangerous job. Let's take it out of the sort of real, like, fictional Elliot Ness. You are living life dangerously. You're on the edge. And you've just had another baby. That's craziness. And her reaction is like, shall I paint the kitchen blue or shall I paint it yellow? Like, she'd have more to say.
It's Charlize Theron.
Yeah, the guy who I love, obviously. But she's meant to have gone fucking mental.
Devil's advocate. Yeah.
The bit where he misses the birth, turns up, goes, I might die soon. And her words are, I understand.
I know.
I really do.
And she's like, I wanted to be. I know you did. Fucking try harder than that.
So Elliot Ness is a special agent of the Treasury Department, and his job is to stop the flow of illegal liquor. He meets his men and he says to them, I know that many of you take a drink. Now we must be pure. I'm not sure your army of Irish cops are going to be having that.
No, they're definitely. But that's to show his naivety, isn't it? That he thinks that will do it, and they'll go, oh, yep. Okay, cool, no problem.
Yeah, yeah, and we've got to show that he doesn't start out on the best foot, really. There's a large shipment of Canadian whiskey arriving in Chicago, apparently. Turns out it's umbrellas.
Yeah.
Famous Canadian whiskey.
And then we have what I think is a poor headline. Crusader cop busts out. He throws the newspaper in the river and he gets told off by a cop called Malone.
On a bridge. Symbolism.
He tells Malone off back. I did have a question here for you. I always like to pepper in questions. But
You do always like to pepper in the odd question.
The question is, how are we feeling about Sean Connery's accent?
Oh, I think we've covered it.
Yeah.
It's abysmal.
I wrote, he said he was doing an Irish accent. It's like me saying I'm currently doing a Dutch accent. But it's a nice scene between the pair of them. That you see their skills, their intelligence, and the fact that there's always the respect from them from the off.
Yeah.
Between each other. And we cut from that to Capone having breakfast. And again, it gives him a second big entrance.
Yeah,
arguably every scene is a big entrance.
Even though
down the sweeping staircase.
Yeah. But the breakfast, he doesn't move.
No, but the camera comes to him.
But that's what I mean. You still feel like he has come to you, even though he's not moved a muscle. And with the barber's chair as well, he barely moves. Yeah, and it's in some ways, it's the barber's chair thing. Is he is so invulnerable and untouchable himself that he can be vulnerable because someone has a razor to his throat, but there's no way that anything untoward would happen because of who he is. And the breakfast in bed thing, I think it can be quite infantilizing, like, or like you're ill. And maybe that's just because that would only ever happen to me if I was an infant or ill. But it's quite a vulnerable place to be in bed.
Don't the boys ever bring you breakfast in bed?
No.
Not once.
Oh, I'm going to have a word with Mark.
Not even on your birthday.
No. Wow. No, I'm just doing a little
Not even a cup of coffee.
A cup of coffee, maybe. Oh, right, yeah. Right.
I know what we're doing for Vicky on her birthday this year.
You're going to come round to my house for breakfast?
Yeah, I've got a set of keys.
What breakfast are we making?
Eggs.
Loads
Brilliant.
Of eggs.
Just loads of eggs.
Every different kind.
Eggs five ways.
I would I'd love it. Just give me buckets of we've boiled some eggs. Jesus Christ.
But it is true. Like, every scene where Capone is completely motionless, he's also in a scene where he's in control.
Yeah.
And whenever he's in motion, it's where something has gone wrong or he's angry.
Oh, wow.
When he's walking around the table at the big dinner.
Oh, yeah.
Just before he bats someone in the head, when he loses his cool with Ness on the stairs.
Yeah.
Both those
That's
moments.
Interesting, because they say that stillness is power and power is stillness sometimes, don't they? Mm. Oh, that's very good, Al. So we're into building the team now, because Ness wants to start a team. He wants Malone on that team. Malone does not want to be on that team. He just wants to stay alive.
It's more important for me to stay alive.
Excellent, thank you for that.
Yep. Irish accent there.
We're sticking to script structure here, though. This is the refusal of the call.
It is, yeah.
We meet accountant Oscar Wallace, played by Charles Martin Smith, and he's assigned to work with Elliot Ness, and he from the off says Capone hasn't filed his income tax, and I like this kind of writing because it lets the audience be ahead of the characters.
I found it a bit frustrating.
Okay, do you think it happens too early?
Yeah,
because he's repeating himself several times, isn't he?
And we all know how it goes.
Yeah.
So when Kevin Costner ignores him, you're like, oh, that's frustrating, because I'm just waiting for you to go, what's that now, tax evasion? Cool. For Wallace to be ignored straight away, it's funny at first, and then you're like, that's just frustration, because we all know that you need to listen to him.
And it goes on a bit longer each time. Like the first time he goes, here, there's income tax evasion. He's like, shut up, not that. And then on the train he goes, it's income tax evasion. He goes, tell me more. Yeah. And then he goes, and still shut up. It's like, he's like, a bit longer. But no.
We get Malone's speech about the Chicago way in church holding a rosary. So this was originally written to be on the street, but Connery was the one who said, let's do it in church. He said, I'm an Irish Catholic. I'm talking in a sacred place. No one would eavesdrop there.
Yes, you are, Sean. You're an Irish Catholic.
Glad you said it.
And of course, famously, you've got the heeples. Oh, sorry, do you want to say it, Alex?
Well, he pulls a gun. He pulls a knife. You pull a gun.
I can't do it. I've lost it. Even me. I don't want to do this.
Even
anymore.
Me.
Even me. The man of a thousand voices. He's lost his Connery.
I'm sorry. I think we just need to take a minute.
Wow.
That's astounding.
That was a slip up
even,
on my part.
Even Rory Bremner over there had an issue.
I do love you for that.
I forgot to pretend.
The mask has slipped. Yes, me.
Yeah, in a voice, be humble. Be humble.
brilliant.
But this film is one of the few times I can remember being aware of the Oscars. I guess I was 8 or 9 when it came out. And I just remember this clip being on the telly all the time, because I guess all the chat would have been about Connery's going to win an Oscar. Finally, Connery's going to get his Oscar. And so in the run up to the Oscars and then afterwards, I just remember seeing this. It was just the perfect Oscar clip.
It was great.
It's Oscar bait.
The way it's shot as well, like just the angle of like Costner's head in the foreground and Connery just behind him. It looks immaculate.
And they're in a church, and it's almost biblical what he's saying, because he's taking an eye for an eye to the next level, essentially.
Can you explain the saying, this town stinks like a whorehouse at low tide? Because I didn't understand it.
Yeah, I can.
Great.
Because it would...
Did they build them on beaches?
Not beaches. Well, maybe. Sorry, that was... I don't know. Maybe they do. not beaches. Sorry, I don't know.
Are you kidding?
On a beach.
So sandal getting everything?
By canals and rivers.
Right.
Like, back in the day, a long time ago, you would build these low structures. You would build these low structures, and it would wash out the latrines when the tide went down. So that's why it would smell.
Why specifically would a whorehouse smell that bad?
I imagine what he's inferring, that the standards of hygiene and cleanliness are lower than in perhaps a hostelry or a private residence.
Oh, I see.
Alex doesn't know. He's never been to one.
Oh, right. Sorry. Right, of course. And I do build them for a living. So.
I figured it was best if you took this one.
That's why I was cross about the beaches. I can't crack that market.
They shake hands in the church. And I think it's De Palma who said the idea here is it's like the fingers touching in the Sistine Chapel, because suddenly life sparks in both of them as this relationship begins.
Sorry, pretentious much. This is basically the Sistine Chapel right now.
When do we get some of the quotes on Thursday's episode?
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, good.
Yeah, you're going to love those, kiddo.
So Ness doesn't want rotten apples. He's going to recruit more people, and he wants unmarried men. That is very important. Mm. We meet George Stone.
I can't be the only one who's married. It'll interfere with my character.
We meet George Stone, played by Andy Garcia, whose real name is Giuseppe. So we get some
fruity language.
Fruity language. Thieving wop. Mm. Stinking Irish pig.
Yep. Yeah.
But it's definitely a case of Garcia shooting his shot when he shows up and he's in the presence of Connery and he absolutely goes for it. And it's inspiring to watch.
He's incredible.
Great. Yeah.
Yeah.
So good. He doesn't even say very much in that scene.
No.
It's when he laughs at him and he's like, oh, you're on the team. And he just goes, okay. Or he says, yeah, or something like that. Like one word and you're like, oh my God. Like, it's so good.
Still quite a big swing to have an argument with a superior officer and pull a gun on them in a fight.
He's a maverick.
A real fucking maverick. Yeah. It's like we don't want him. He's not well. Yeah. He's got some real anger issues.
But the language that Sean Connery is using here, the racist language?
Yes.
So I thought he was doing it. He's like, I'm winding this kid up because I want to see what he's made of. And so I'm using these epithets because it will get a rise out of him. We'll see what he does.
But,
so I was like, okay, that's not fine. But within the, you know, rough and tumble of this, I get it. But then he does it at the end to his assassin.
Yeah.
And so I was like, oh, what? So is that who you are? Am I supposed to feel so? I don't know.
I mean, you could argue that in both those cases, he's in the first case, like you say, he's trying to get a rise out of Stone. And in the second case, he's dealing with someone who was just about to kill him.
Sure.
So perhaps his emotions run high. But yeah, I see your point.
He's also an old school racist, maybe, you know? And, you know, we talk about this sometimes when we do films like this. I mean, are they just using the vernacular of the time that they would imagine this is the language this man would use?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just whether or not you want to feel sorry, who you want, sorry, not feel sorry for him, but like who you want him, who you think he is.
Yeah, but people are more than just one thing.
They are.
Have you heard that?
I
don't know whether you know, but I think I may have told you before.
You can add that into your I'm a sensitive guy routine, and you can say to a woman at some point, I've just sort of realised over the years, you know, hey, people aren't just one thing, and she will fucking love it. You can have that from me.
I appreciate what you've just said, and I see you.
You can't Ricky repeating it. Thank you.
who said that?
I like the bit where the police chief sees Malone in his civvies and goes, Jimmy, what the hell are you dressed for? Halloween, says a man who has no idea what Halloween is. It's like, really? This is a brown suit.
Well, it's very meta, isn't it? It's like, I've come in a period costume.
Fun fact, Connery's the only one who didn't wear an Armani suit.
Oh,
he
okay.
said my character wouldn't, and he wore his own clothes, apparently,
what?
By all accounts.
Okay.
And used his own accent.
We're going to take a break now, but we're going to come back with their first assignment.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And we're back with the first assignment.
I appreciate the Police Academy reference.
No problem, Al. That was for you.
Thank you.
And I see you. Say it to him. No, you feel safe.
Not trying to chat him up.
You feel safe.
Not trying to chat you up. They're going on a liquor raid at a post office. And this is when the... Well, we've already had some great Ennio Morricone music in this film. But this is when the most stunning bit of score kicks in and it lifts you out of your seat. Mm. And it's funny, the actors were saying that when they all saw it together in a private screening room in New York just before the premiere, and they just said that that scene was... along lots of scenes and lots of takes and lots of stuff going on, and to see it cut together as a montage with this music they'd never heard, they were just like, oh, we're in a movie here.
Oh,
and Kevin, what do you think of my Irish accent? it's great, Sean.
They say if you walk through this door now, you're walking into a world of trouble and there's no turning back. This is really playing by all the screenwriting rules, because they're crossing the threshold now. And he's telling us and them that they're crossing the threshold. They arrest everyone, they impound everything, and they beat the crap out of everyone. Mm. Some pretty hardcore police violence going on in this film.
Yeah.
Yes, sort
it's
of
the Chicago way.
It
Chris.
Is. It is. It's the Death Wish,
but that's
right wing.
Ruined by Chicago Town Pizza.
Because possibly, yeah. Potentially, yeah.
Pizza, the Chicago way.
The point being that Elliot Ness's thing is no alcohol. It's the law. It's basically like, I don't really give a shit what it is, but the law is the law kind of thing. And you can imagine that those cops that he sees at first, he's like, I understand you guys take a drink. They're obviously all probably on the make a little bit. They're probably turning a blind eye in return for booze and all the rest of it. But his purity of mission or honour does not extend to violence. So he's picking and choosing as well. Because as a police officer, you're not entitled to beat the shit out of people, even back then, I think. Like, I'm sure the use of reasonable force was maybe a bit more lax or whatever. But so he's all right with that, but he's not all right with alcohol. And that's good, because it's sort of moral complexity, isn't it? He isn't just an avenging angel kind of thing.
Yep. Yep. Enthusiasm, baseball, teamwork.
Oh, wait, before that, just one aside. You know when they've done the first mission and it's gone well and they have the photograph taken in the cafe? Yeah. The way Malone sits, the way Connery poses for that photo is so good, because it's like, I guess photos still weren't that commonplace, and he sort of changes from this quite, I don't know, like hard, old, you know, weather-worn cop, and he just sort of sits up like a school kid having his photograph taken. He sits up really straight and sort of like poses, because it's still special to him to have his photograph taken.
I do that. De Niro's so commanding and charismatic in that scene. I remember it being very upsetting as a child.
It's great.
I definitely shut my eyes a second into it. And so in my head, you see a lot more than you actually do. Right. I think you see one crack, don't you? And you see the blood spreading.
Yeah.
But we really cut to him and the other people when he's doing the hitting. So it's all in your head, really.
Being spattered with blood. And then the guy, when the blood's pooling around his head and it's shot from the top and his cigar's all crumpled in the blood. It's great.
I'm trying to get a sense if this is based on a true story or not, and I read a version of it where he killed three people with a baseball bat and another where he didn't kill anyone. So it's intercut with or it cuts straight to Elliot Ness putting his kids to bed. So frustrating as sort of the family aspect of it is important to show this contrast between this family man and this bloke who's just has no morals whatsoever.
Yeah, and his wife says, do you want to come upstairs and brush my hair?
Which hair?
Oh, great point, Chris.
It's code for hello.
Would it be if he began, what hair, though?
Some Merkin fun.
I think you'd probably take a Merkin off to brush it, though.
Ah, gosh, would you?
It depends how hard it is to attach and unattach. If you've glued it on, you're probably going to not bother.
Yeah, but I mean, I think you'd probably take it off at night.
And
anyway.
Would it have its own little stand? Well, a Merkin stand.
I don't know, because you're not sure who's going to come. If you have a workman round in there, he's like, oh, what's that? And it's a Merkin on your bedside table. You'd probably keep it in a drawer.
Oh, that's such a good point.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Excellent point.
Thought for the future, me.
We've got an attempted bribe by the alderman here. And the reason I bring that up, because he's played by someone called Del Close. Do you know Del Close?
No.
Who are we talking about? Which character?
The alderman. The man who's funny, almost a bit funny looking. He's got funny teeth and he tries to bribe Elliot Ness in his office.
Oh, yes. Yeah, he looked really familiar.
Yeah, I think his name is more familiar than he is, but I'm a real geek for LA comedy scene in the 70s and Saturday Night Live, and I love reading about that period. And he is the guy. That actor was the godfather of comedy improvisation. So these were his improv students. Dan Aykroyd, John Belushi, John Candy, Tina Fey, John Favreau, Bill Murray, Mike Myers, Amy Poehler, Bob Odenkirk, Harold Ramis, Jason Sudeikis, Vince Vaughn.
Wow.
He is the guy. He's responsible for most of the comedy we like that comes out of America.
Yep. And even he didn't like Four Christmases.
He's the guy who says you folks think you're untouchable. So I like it. The title in the dialogue in the title, the title in the dialogue. This is the moment now where our man meets Frank Nitti, played by Billy Drago, who says to him, nice to have a family.
Yeah.
What do we think of Billy Drago's look in this film?
Fantastic.
So you're smiling and saying fantastic. Vicky is just shaking her head.
I don't want to be down on the way. So I just don't. It's too ghoulish. Like, I don't know. It just is.
I mean, that is his face.
Yeah, no, I know. That's an awful thing to say, isn't it? Like,
what you mean is, look, I think that you mean, we're talking about the white suit. I think it's great. It's a guy, because he's so into what he does. Like, if he was just dressed regular, I mean, like, I think the costumes in this versus Road to Perdition, like, this wins hands down. But also, it's like, it's a guy who fancies himself, who thinks it's cool what he does.
Sure, I see that. I just think, it's not very practical.
I mean,
thank you. Yeah. Yeah, you can get me a drink, no problem. What was I going to say? It's just that, well, he's covered in blood. He will be covered in blood a lot of the time. Like, he has an assassin role in this. So the white thing is like, that's impractical. Like, you could do the cool thing, cool uniform with black. I don't know.
This is very Brian De Palma, though, isn't it? His direction does tend to draw attention to what he's doing. And he's saying to the audience, look at this guy. From the first minute, this person is important. But also, I don't give a fuck that he would never wear a white suit.
Yeah.
I like the look of red on white. Therefore, he's wearing a white suit for that. I love that colour.
I like red on everything. it's just, I found him very scary. I found him very ghoulish. I'm supposed to. He's like a grim reaper rather than like a person. And if you know that Frank Nitti's real and then you see him, like the way Stanley Tucci does it, it's just so much more, there's depth to that. And there's a shallowness here that I think is on purpose to make him seem like an apparition kind of thing. Mm. It's just not for me, but I don't know why.
Stalwart of 80s action cinema, though, wasn't he? If you needed a henchman or a bad guy, he'd pop up. It just has one of those faces. They decide they're going to link Capone to the money. That is the job now. So they head to Canada. And we're suddenly on horses on the wide open plains on the border. And this is De Palma and Mamet saying they wanted to do something just different with the gangster movie. Take it out of Chicago. Make it like a John Ford film, because this is all about the idea of pure good versus pure evil. They wanted to make it look a bit different visually, give it another texture, stick it in another genre. Interestingly, this was originally them running.
Instead of being on horseback.
Yeah, and they rehearsed it and they apparently look ridiculous. You look ridiculous.
I'd love it if all these cool guys just couldn't run well. Just flailing arms. And I'm not sure about the comedy Canadian Mounties, the Canadian police, the leader. It's a bit too broad. I'm not sure I believe in your methods.
I think Wallace goes berserk, like berserker kind of thing. And I think that's meant to be for comedic effect and I really hate it.
Yeah,
I just thought it's also, where am I? Like, I'm in a world of real violence where real things can happen. A child got killed at the start, all the rest of it, and then didn't he kick someone in the balls and they like fall down dead? I don't like it.
It's interesting because I mean I'm buying to him going berserk. He's just seen his friend Stone get shot, and I think he's fucking angry here, and I like seeing that. But the moment where he drinks the whiskey. Because there's a bullet hole in the whiskey. He didn't want to do that scene, Smith. He said he kept worrying that his character was turning into a buffoon, which you're agreeing with, I think. And De Palma said to him, no, I'm going to have them laughing with you until you die, which will really work for your character. And I'm sort of more on that side. But yeah, he was concerned. He had that concern as
and
well.
Also, I mean, bearing in mind, we actually hear Ness at the start say, I don't want anyone to drink. You imagine that he's brought that same theory to the Untouchables. Guys, don't drink. And it sort of seems disrespectful to his boss to then take a drink, even as a joke.
Are you being serious?
Yeah. Don't you think?
He's just killed three men for the first time in his life.
All right.
There's whiskey pouring out of a hole next to him.
In the litany of reasons to have a drink.
Yeah, it's a good okay. moment.
I'll tell you, well, when I've killed three men, I'll let you know whether I have whiskey.
It's a good movie moment. But Ness is gets upset here. He's regretting the kidding that he's done. He shouts, what is this, a game?
Yeah, but what did he think was going to happen? I find this really confusing. I don't mind it because it's an excellent film. But Malone could not have been clearer. Like, we are going to war. Bad things are going to happen. You need to bring a gun. If you go through that door, there is fucking warnings all over the place. There's been a scary man outside his house. Nice to have a family. What did you think was going to happen? Yeah. Then he's like, wife. Can't even remember her name. Wife, where is child? Like, whatever. Yes, of course that was going to happen. Like, what the fuck did you think? And then when he kills someone, he's like, I've killed someone. It's like, yes, we know. But I don't mind your naivety in that situation, but I do mind the sort of the anger at your own naivety. Mm. Like, you've been told really clearly.
But it's interesting. It's interesting because they've chosen for the guy who he kills in that moment. It's not a guy who's basically going, I'm not going to put down my gun. Mm. I'm going to shoot you. It's because he doesn't understand him, because he doesn't speak English. And so it's almost like Ness kills someone, not because they were going to kill him, but because they didn't understand his command, which kind of makes him more culpable for killing them.
Yeah, I agree.
Which is dark.
Very dark. A bit lighter, though, is Malone threatens and then kills a dead man.
Now that works. That's funny, and that works.
He blows a dead man's brains out. I was trying to find out if this is the first time we've ever seen that on film, because it's such a great idea.
Yeah.
It's such a brilliant concept.
Yeah.
It's so clever.
Weekend at Bernie's?
After this.
Yeah, you're right. You're right, after this. And don't let him clean himself up until after he talks.
And so, yes, they, as you say, they need the ledger translated. And so that's how they make that happen. Cut to Capone. He's got a speech. I want him dead. I want his family dead. I want to piss on his ashes. Just great De Niro. Giving us great De Niro.
Yeah. So good.
Mm. Although I would like to see the Hoskins version, but loving great De Niro. And so they put the warrant out for Capone now, and he could get 28 years in prison. Next up, Oscar's death.
Oh,
so we've got a huge, long, what they call a one-er, a single shot, and it's De Palma. It's the ticking time bomb, another Hitchcock sequence that he puts one of these in all his films. Oscar enters the lift. Nitty's working the lift. Nitty kills the witness and Oscar, and writes in blood on the wall on touchable.
Touchable.
Just think how long that would take to write touchable.
Daub. Walk, more
would
blood.
You have like to put, you are in a rush.
Would you have to put bullets in different places? Just if you to run get, out of blood, I've run out of blood
to
here.
To get the resources,
it stop pumping out of your tummy. I need your bum.
It's just it works so well though when Oscar is all like, yeah, I got to come out shooting, and he's all blasé about it. And then the minute he's blasé, the minute he doesn't respect the job, dead.
Why are they letting the accountant dude protect Frank Nitti?
Yeah.
Lads!
We've got loads of police officers.
You know how good Stone is at shooting? Not him. Let's not use him.
Mike, the Irish police chief, actors from Texas. I did want to check his accent. It didn't sound good.
Oh, goodness me.
He tells Malone not to get involved and to take the day off. So we're looking at him sideways, aren't we, already? And we've got the moment now where Elliot Ness approaches Al Capone, which never happened, in his hotel. I quite like the line, you talk like that to me in front of my son, fuck you, your family.
It's awesome. It's because it shows
you got nothing! You got nothing!
That's my favourite line. Nothing! I love that! It's because I like it so much, because, again, Kevin Costner playing Elliot Ness is like a petty idiot. You don't go and offer Al Capone out for a fight.
No.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
But it brings Al Capone, like, back down to street level, because he's like, who is this person? You're in my home, kind of thing. Look at everything I have. I'm not even going to talk to you because you're so far beneath my consideration. And by just goading him and screaming at him and saying, I'm going to punch you in the face, whatever he says, Al Capone then becomes himself, which is like, fuck you, you've got nothing, kind of thing. And I like that. I wish it was somehow the undoing of him. Mm. It's not. He's just got him to shout at him in a lobby, and it doesn't. There's no consequences to that. But but whatever.
I think it's the moment where De Niro almost goes too far. I think with the performance,
right?
It's the one time I'm taken out of it a little bit. And also, I'm trying to get a sense of, is this Al Capone? Did you watch Boardwalk Empire?
No.
Stephen Graham plays Al Capone in that, and you know, obviously, great casting.
Yeah.
But he's slightly more controlled than this guy. I mean, he gets angry and loses his temper and kills people, but he's slightly more controlled. And I just, this is the one moment I'm not
100%.
It's not, but I think I think like you said, V, it's the fact that like he's been so suave, he's got all the patter with the press, and you forget that he is just this brute, this hoodlum, who's now playing at being decadent and refined, but actually he's a brawler, and you get to see that in this scene.
Mm. So now the Untouchables are arguing amongst themselves. We've got the Dark Knight of the Soul, and next up is Malone's death.
Oh, in a scene called Home Malone. Fucking hell.
Well, I called it Malone's death when that was there, sitting
Home
there.
Home Malone.
That's amazing. My God.
Can I tell you something I thought about this, and then tell me where this is from? I've seen this film only once before. Because of the tracking shot, because of the horror film music, because of the... It's gorgeous. I thought Malone had hidden Stone in the shower. And so he knew someone was coming for him. And he was playing it being, I'm just an old man having a drink and nothing to see here. Uh-huh. And he knew that someone was coming because, of course he knew, because his old friend with the bad accent just told him, he said, I'm talking to a dead man. And why would a seasoned cop like Malone go, cool, I'll just go home then.
Play some music.
And play some music and just have a drink. So I was like, no, one of the other gang is in the shower and they're going to burst out, and it all still will go wrong, and he'll still meet his end. But he's luring them into a trap.
Yeah, I've literally wrote exactly the same thing down. But I thought, because again, it's been ages since I've seen this, I thought the guy was going to follow him from window to window to window, and then as Malone walked back and he reached the final window, Malone was going to be standing there with a gun.
Yeah.
That's what I'd have done.
Why do we both think that?
This is the creeper sequence, as De Palma calls it, though. And he puts one of these in most of his films. And I'm sure we saw one in Scarface and one in Carlito's Way, and we've got to do the horror film at some point. But yeah, so you've got the camera stalking around the rooms and around the side of the apartment. We've got the killer's point of view, and he's crafting the suspense through all those techniques and tricks that he so much loves. And he gets shot dead, Malone. So,
well, not quite. Takes a lot of bullets, but survives till morning.
And can talk.
Yeah.
And write. Mm. And do most things that a live person can do.
Yeah, but...
Because he's so fucking hard.
Well, Connery's one of the few people I believe that of. Certainly one of the few actors who does seem tough enough to take a few bullets. It's cut with Capone watching opera and crying. It's by split screen intercut with Malone crawling through his apartment. It's very melodramatic.
Yeah.
But that's, I feel like that's what you want from this director and this material.
Oh, yeah.
He managed to give them the message of the trained bookkeeper is being taken out of town on.
The bit where Ness says... Stay to Malone. Honestly, that got me.
Really?
I loved it. Yeah, when he's holding him, he's like, stay. Mm.
But he has to die because this is the motivation that Elliot Ness needs to do the stuff he doesn't think he's capable of.
Kill mode, go!
So we've got the station sequence. This is something that De Palma does a lot, a task the protagonist has to do, but these impediments keep getting put in his way. We have seen that a lot in Carlito's Way and Scarface.
Yep.
It's just something he does.
Yep.
In the original script, Mamet had written, this happens with trains crashing into each other, but they couldn't afford it.
Yeah, this is great. I mean, if this was in Carlito's Way, though, like Elliot Ness would be going, God damn. Jesus.
I cannot
Mother
tell
and
you
baby.
How many times I say to myself, ain't no friends in this shit business. I said it to myself this morning. I say it all the time.
Ain't no friends in this shit business.
I fucking love that film.
So essentially, David Mamet was working on, I think, his directorial debut at this point. So they had to make this up as they went along, as they couldn't use the scene that they planned. And
you're saying make it up, borrow it wholesale.
Well, just nick it.
So it's from the battleship Potemkin, the pram coming down the steps. I guess the idea is Elliot Ness has just had a baby. And so there's something going on with him there, and you've got this innocent in the middle of all the violence, and you've got Morricone's music box sort of score.
Take the bags to the top of the stairs.
Jesus Christ.
Go back for the pram. Do them as separate events. Go step by step with bag, pram. It's insane.
I've run it a million times because I was like, what are you doing with this baby? That makes sense. It makes sense now, but it makes even more sense for the times if the station was busy. Because she's like, if I put the baby at the top without the bags, they'll steal my baby, or they'll steal my bags. It's deserted. What the fuck are you doing?
Yep. I've written down too much build-up. Do you think there's too much build-up here? it goes on for a long time.
To the point where I thought she, again, I know this doesn't happen, I thought she was going to be like, hey, babe, oh, you're being so good. And then was going to, underneath, here's a fucking machine gun, bitch. That's what I thought was going to happen. Because women don't have much to do in this. There's one woman in the scene where Wallace gets killed and she comes out of a doorway or out of a lift and she's got this look on her face like she's part of the gang somehow, like she's done something. And then you're like, oh, no, you're just an extra, just being cool and doing your thing. So I was like, a woman's got to be able to do something. And even though I know it didn't happen, this woman is taking such a long time to do the most basic task that I thought she was a gangster.
Yeah, but I mean, you got to remember, that's very personal to you because you're the only person I've met who actually carried a gun in their pram when you were pushing your children around. I know the mean streets of Lewisham are...
You can't say things like that. They'll come for me.
It's just one of those... She brings a knife to the creche, you bring a gun.
I just think you could introduce the characters and show us the geography and get things going a bit quicker. And there are times with Brian De Palma where I feel like he's wanting to draw attention to himself and what he's doing. And I think he's guilty of it here. This is considered one of the great gangster scenes, and I really think it's really overrated.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, I like it.
Takes me out of the movie.
But
a little
I don't.
Bit.
I only like it when it gets going. I only like it when he lets go of the pram. The build up is too much.
We had so much jeopardy at the start. I don't feel too bad about ruining it. But when we come to my best scene, you're going to get a shock, Chris.
Yeah, it's overrated by dum dums. But it's cool. It's cool that we've set up Stone as the sharpshooter, though, and it pays off here. Oh, yeah. You got him. Yeah, I got him. Take him. That is very satisfying. So we're in court. And the bookkeeper's giving everything up.
If this movie couldn't do even more, it ends with a courtroom drama. I was like, oh my God, is this the greatest film ever? We've gone from ultra-violence to a courtroom drama.
Not just a courtroom drama. Capone's going to lose, but he's yawning. Mm. Why is he yawning?
Oh my gosh.
And Ness takes Nitty outside. There's some business. He figures out Nitty's got Malone's address. Why has he got Malone's address?
Just a question. Is 1634 a scene that hard to remember that you need to write it in your matches? It's not.
Yeah. I have a bit of a problem here.
Have you got it written down?
Yeah.
Well, you didn't remember it then.
The cop gets shot by Nitty after Ness is like, don't let him go, let him go. And then the cop goes, no, I'm not going to let him go. Mm-hmm. And then Nitty shoots him and the cop hasn't even hit the ground before he says to Ness, take my gun. And you're like, this is too quick. He needs to be more dying or something. He's like, take my gun.
So we got the rooftop chase and Ness has Nitty in his sights, but he hesitates and Nitty smiles and baits him and says, come on, arrest me. And he pulls him up because he's off the side of the building to arrest him. And then Nitty says, he died like a pig. And Elliot Ness pushes him off the roof and he smashes into a car.
Did he sound anything like that?
Great. That's the Chicago way. Yeah. He's asked, where's Nitty? He's in the car.
Yeah.
So this is not how Frank Nitty died. Would you like to hear how Frank Nitty died?
Yeah.
Oh, I read about this. Go on. You tell me.
With a gun to his own head.
Yeah.
The first shot fired by Nitty's unsteady hand. So I thought you could only shoot yourself in the head once.
Right.
Turns out you can shoot yourself in the head several times.
Oh, my God.
The first shot missed and passed through his fedora. The second bullet slammed into the right side of his jaw and exited through the top of his head, taking a lock of his hair and leaving it a tuft protruding through the hole in the crown of his fedora. He did another shot after that. Oof, the final bullet...
He shot himself in the head while wearing a hat.
Yes.
Okay.
He was very drunk, by the way. Mm. The final fatal bullet entered behind Nitty's right ear and lodged in the top of his skull. So, yeah.
They were extorting movie studios and the gang after Al Capone had died. So Frank Nitty was in charge, I think. Was that right?
Yes, yeah. He was.
So they were extorting movie studios, which you know about from that film, The Godfather. And so they were all indicted. That film. That one. Sorry, I don't know why I did that.
Yeah, there was that little movie. Oh, my God. Yeah,
stay
blah,
tuned.
Blah, blah, blah.
Remember Michelle's high school reunion?
And so they were all indicted and they knew that what they were going to have to do a bit of time. And they sort of agreed that it was Frank's turn to do time, but he was really claustrophobic. And so rather than do it, someone had to do it. They were banged to rights kind of thing. Uh-huh. He took his own life instead.
Wow.
Yeah. He was really young. They were all really young.
Jeez.
Yeah, we're probably all younger than the actors who are playing them.
Well, yeah, Al Capone was 32 in these events. Yeah. Robert De Niro's not 32 there.
So the jury's been bribed, so they switched the jury with next door's jury by telling the judge that then his name was in the ledger.
Why does this work?
Because the judge has been bribed in the past, I guess.
So he just
presumes.
Dodgy.
He presumes that his name's in the ledger.
But the judge... Oh, I see. It's not... Okay, so I think I got confused as well, because I thought it was a ledger specifically for this trial. And
right.
the judge would know that he hadn't taken a bribe for this particular trial.
I see.
But it just meant overall. Right, so he was
so.
Crooked.
Okay. I think potentially, yeah. I think that's what that
is
comment...
Is okay.
Yeah.
I don't know that you can just switch a jury like that. It's like, sorry, we were on a murder trial in the other room and we've listened to a lot of evidence, but you want us to just pop in here to do the verdict on this?
I quite liked it. I took it to be like, you could definitely do it. You know, I'm like, I love it when you learn something new in films. It's like, that's the thing you can do.
But it means that we watch Al Capone losing his shit. Mm. They withdraw their plea of not guilty and enter a plea of guilty. And that's when Elliot Ness approaches him and says, never stop fighting till the fight is done. Here endeth the lesson. Oh, a bit of a callback. And then we've got a very, very angry Al Capone being held back. It's always satisfying watching the villain being held back when he's lost, isn't it?
Yep.
It's like at the end of a boxing match or something. It's just very good. So Capone sentenced to 11 years. Mm. And that's the end, really. We get another look at that photo from earlier. The team sort of disbands. He gives the rosary to Stone because he believes a cop, Stone, he would have wanted a cop to have it. And then Prohibition, what would Elliot Ness do if Prohibition is repealed? And his line is...
I'll have a drink.
Mm.
Which is brilliant. Which is absolutely brilliant, because he's just, I'm a lawman and I just do what the law tells me. And it's not that I hate booze or I believe in temperance or anything. I just do what I'm supposed to do. And so if Prohibition ends, I will have a drink.
Ended up with a drink problem.
Did he?
Yeah.
Oh, that's sad.
Elliot Ness. He even had a pretty bad car accident when he was drunk, which he tried to cover up himself. So he wasn't really covered in glory. Also, like the Elliot Ness presented here, you did a bit of research on him. He was married 3 times. He had no children by birth, but adopted a boy 15 years after all this happened.
Okay.
And in terms of meeting Al Capone, he did actually meet him. I think IMDb and Wikipedia say he didn't. But on May the 3rd, 1932, Ness was among the federal agents who took Capone from the Cook County Jail elsewhere and put him on a train. So they did meet after he'd been arrested.
Is that when he... Because he ended up in Alcatraz, didn't he? He died in Alcatraz.
No, he died at home. He was released from... He was moved from Alcatraz to there, wherever you just said.
Right.
Then he went home because he had neurosyphilis.
Yes.
So then there was this conspiracy that, is he faking dementia to get out of prison? But he was really ill, so he went home and he died at home.
Got you.
Mm.
Yeah, because that's what the Tom Hardy film's about, where he plays Capone. That
oh,
came
the
out
Josh
recently.
Trank one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Which I don't know anyone that's seen.
Nope.
It's supposed to be horrible. I mean, Tom Hardy playing Al Capone. Yep. Yeah. Mm. Oh, really? maybe not. Just one last thing. There was a very different ending planned for this film. The original ending, you had Capone, the final image was Capone lying back in a chair, and it was a close-up of him being shaved again.
Mm.
And then as it pulled up, you realise he's now in his jail cell being shaved.
Right.
But De Palma stopped them the day before shooting it. He said, it's not right, it's not going to work. And so... But I think it would have nicely bookended the film.
It would have done. I know what you're talking about, start and end on the same image, but the opposite. But I think it would have shown him having a fine time in jail. And you don't want to think that.
And
you know.
Frame literally bookends it. It's his film then. Is it meant to be about Elliot Ness? Is it meant to be about Al Capone? Mm. I think we think it's about Elliot Ness, and Al Capone is a huge figure in it.
Yeah.
But I think over the years, we think of it as Elliot Ness's story, which is why it's disappointing that it's not true. But if you have the start and end image, that's your story, isn't it?
Mm.
I think.
Sure.
So, should we do the bits?
Yeah.
What's your favourite scene, Alex?
Oh, Dum-Dum over here. Like, train station stairs scene, because amazing. I thought it was really cool. I love how melodramatic it is. I love, like, everything that shouldn't work and all the over-the-top, like, my baby! and, like, then Stone throwing Ness the gun. Ness saying, take him. It's just, like, it should be ridiculous, and yet it really works, and I don't think the build-up is too long. I think I got more and more tense as that was going along, and I thought it was fantastic. Dum-Dumancer.
Vicky.
Pram steps, catch the baby, bookkeeper, do these things, and give Andy Garcia his moment, which he deserves, because otherwise I don't think he has an arc.
No.
He's a wannabe cop that becomes a cop, that's it. And you have to give him something. Like, I would have given him a lot more to do. Like, I'm very taken with him in this. And so it is brilliant that he gets the best part of the best scene.
Yeah.
How about Dum-Dum over there?
A lot of people did say that at the time, though, I think. Yeah.
What's yours then, Chris?
I love the scene where Oscar kills all the goons with his shotgun when he loses his shit.
Jesus, are you joking?
I love it.
Are you really joking?
Yeah,
it's so bad. It's so bad. When he kicks a man, I love
seeing the little man snap. I can see a lot of myself in him.
Oh, sure. That's fair.
So that is my favourite scene. Most valuable ever, Vicky.
I know the... You think it's over the top when Robert De Niro starts shouting, "You've got nothing," but I just think it's wicked. But it obviously is a bit silly. And then I want to give Andy Garcia it because he's sexy, but that's not a right reason. So Brian De Palma for lifting the Eisenstein Odessa Step sequence and making it brilliant and better. Wow. There we are.
So that's Dum Dum twice, because her reason for her MVW is the stairs.
Yeah, no, a lot of people have written that, so... I don't know where you found it.
Okay. Mine is De Niro. I think he's absolutely fantastic as Al Capone. I think every scene he's in, it's just like a masterclass in just power and like the action he does with his finger. I want him dead. I want his family dead. I want to piss on his ashes. I'm like,
I will say, with gangsters, right?
Yeah.
We only ever see them the gangster films that we've done, especially on the podcast, it's the decline, isn't it? It's like the rise and fall. We do that a lot. And then Al Capone, similarly, the rise and fall. And they're always ruining their fun. So they're at that dinner and he's got a baseball bat and everyone's like, that's fine. Like, they're not allowed to go, why have you got a baseball bat?
And the answer is, I'm going to make a metaphor.
Yeah, but you've brought a prop. I don't know. Like, everyone should be like, oh, shit. And it's like, but you're going to ruin your fancy dinner. Gangsters are always ruining their fun.
I don't believe he ruined the dinner.
No.
I mean, I think he probably sat down and ate around the blood.
Yeah. And said, if anyone dares say a word.
And also, it starts off as quite a positive metaphor. It's like talking about them as
fantastic.
A team. And that's why
great.
He's got the baseball bat. And they're like, oh, I love it. He's brought a prop.
I also loved that because of this, not necessarily just strictly like American thing, but the we talk a lot about the hero's journey and, you know, in storytelling. And we have spoken a lot before, possibly in the pub, so forgive me. The individualization of like heroism and storytelling, it's like one person, usually a man, can change the world and can do everything. And the reality is it's a collective effort. And to have someone like Al Capone go, it is a collective effort, by the way, like it isn't just one man's story. I thought that was a brilliant thing for someone who's such a central figure in all of that to say, it's not just me, it's everybody. But at the end, kind of is just me because I'm the boss.
Yeah.
I loved it. Sorry, I interrupted you.
No, I'd finished.
Okay.
It was more sort of a follow-on, if anything.
A reflection.
Yeah, great. I really appreciate that. I see you.
As you've taken De Niro, I'm going for Ennio Morricone. It's my second favourite Morricone score. I just think it's stunning. And there's good stuff at the beginning, and Capone's theme is good, but that hero theme is just so beautiful and it so elevates the material that I'm voting for him. So, Vicky, what would you change?
Okay, so when Elliot Ness is in Canada, he kills someone and he's really sad about it. He's like, is this a game? And it's like, you've done that. You've crossed that threshold. You killed a man. So when he throws Nitty off the roof, it's a repeat of, you killed a man. And it just doesn't work for me, for Elliot Ness's character. So he should do the right thing, despite the provocation. Obviously, he's being provoked by Nitty, but he should do it because then you've got the arc of, given that we're making stuff up anyway and it's not true to life. So the job nearly ruined him when he killed someone in Canada, but actually it hasn't, and he's found his way back. He does the right thing. So he's being really, really provoked to throw this man off the roof, and he's like, I am still going to put you in prison because I'm doing the right thing.
Is it not that he is, because Nitty says, before he goads him, he says, watch me beat the rap, meaning Nitty's going to be back out and on the street. And is Ness not just scared that Nitty, having already threatened his family, may try and kill his family while Capone's in prison,
just
no matter
take
what?
Take that line out of it, just make it clear that, because he pulls him back up and it's like, you should catch him properly and then send him to prison. But and he's goading him because he knows he's going to go to prison. He's like, I'd rather be dead than in prison, so I do want you to shoot me. And he's like, I won't even give you that.
But isn't that the message of the film, though, that he's got to start using the Chicago way?
Yeah, I suppose. I don't know. No, is it?
Yeah, I think that's what Malone tells him, and then that's what he realises at the end, that I can't beat these people without crossing the line here.
Yeah, but he has just, we're walking into a scene where he just beats everybody. Like, it feels like that quest has finished.
No, because he gets Nitti and he gets Capone.
Yeah.
By both ways. One is using violence and one is telling a lie because the judge's name wasn't on that ledger.
Sure. I don't know. When you think of Elliot Ness, you think he got Al Capone in a way that no one, including Al Capone, thought was possible. Mm. And it was a clean way kind of thing.
Because you can't switch juries at the 11th hour. That's why no one thought it was possible.
Yeah. Al?
Mine's a little bit silly, but given, to use your words, that we are making things up.
I like to have a bit of fun.
You simply should not, in a movie, have three characters called Stone, Malone and Capone. It's ridiculous. Mm. I remember thinking it as a kid going, which one's which? I'm like, Stone, Malone,
and
Capone.
And that scene, they're all eating provolone.
No, it's a really valid change. Well done. Good spot.
Well done. I think we need to have some humour between Elliot Ness and his wife. Just give us something that makes me like them as a couple.
I think she thinks, do you want to brush my hair? It's quite funny.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, I know.
Do you want to take it off and give it to me?
Well, then make a Merkin gag.
I know, 100%.
Yeah, that is what this film's missing. I think a lot of people said that at the time.
I know, replace the scene on the steps with the pram with a Merkin gag. I know Costner isn't exactly a comedy genius, but like that chemistry he has with René Russo in Tin Cup, I just think it's so unfair that Patricia Clarkson just feels like the wife feels like this killjoy.
Oh my God.
And
yeah,
so I want to like them as a couple. And I think it sort of drains the life out of the film a little bit when she's on screen, and that's not fair.
Yeah.
And that's that.
All right. We're done. Quiz.
Do you want a quiz?
Sure.
I've written one.
Oh, okay. If you've written one, I mean, I don't want it to go to waste.
That's I always start picking at this sellotape on the table when you say quiz.
I always put lip balm on.
But we've got these tells.
Very triggering.
We're in the midst of awards season, and so this is a quiz about Best Picture Oscar winners.
Okay.
Sure.
I'm going to give you the year
and
the initials of the film.
Oh, okay. Then it was Best Picture. Okay.
And you've got to give me the title. So if I said, this is not one, but if I said 1980 KVK...
Exactly.
Okay, good. Well done.
I'm so glad that wasn't one because that would have been very difficult and I would have got a lot of shit.
Yeah,
except but it was Vicky.
Everyone on Twitter will go, no, Vicky totally deserves it.
It was Vicky. So, yeah, bonus point potentially.
Thanks to everyone on Twitter.
I'll do it the other way around. I'm going to do the letters first.
Okay.
Okay.
OFOTCN 1976.
One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
Oh, you bastard.
Correct.
Sorry,
Alex.
Language.
Really? You start this podcast with fuck you, motherfuckers.
I actually regretted that when I done it. Maybe we need to speak to Nikki. It's just quite like straight out the gate. It's a bit much.
Yeah, I mean, it's the Untouchables episode. If we were doing Up, I might have questioned it.
And just to say,
bring in those child listeners.
I've tried to pick films you will have heard of. I've not gone super obscure from 1923 or whatever. So
Wings.
DMD 1990.
Oh, heck.
1990, DMD.
Not a great Best Picture winner. Not considered a...
Driving Miss Daisy!
Correct.
Oh...
I got it from not a great Best Picture winner.
Yep. Okay. NCFOM.
Oh, Jesus. Just wait. You're speaking too quickly.
And the year is 2008.
No Country for Old Men.
Correct.
Oh, thank God.
Correct.
Thank God.
Okay. B. And the year is 1996.
Babe, Pig in the City.
96. Oh, Braveheart.
Correct!
Oh!
We are neck and neck. Okay. WSS. And the year is 1961. A famous Best Picture winner. He won a bunch of Oscars.
Oh, wait. I can't go too early.
It's a musical.
West Side Story.
Correct! Oh, Alex, you need this.
I know.
You really need this.
Otherwise, I won't be hosting the Oscar coverage this year.
But I will.
Yeah. Yes, this is the prize.
Yep. I'll tell Sky about this episode. You'll be getting a call if you win.
TSOTL. The year is 1991. We've done it on the podcast.
Oh, no.
It got three... wins, I believe. And it is only the third and last Best Picture winner to win all the five big awards.
The Silence of the Lambs!
Correct.
Oh.
Alex. Alex, Silence of the Lambs!
Oh, what a film!
Yeah. Yeah, that's so, tiebreaker.
Okay.
I remembered to write one.
Oh, it was nice when we had a draw last week.
Do you want to just leave it at a draw?
Oh, can we?
No.
Oh, Alex!
All right, yes, fine.
All right, we'll leave it at a draw.
Really?
Yeah, yeah, why not? Well played.
Yay!
Very good game.
Okay.
Good game, good game.
Just for fun, what was the last one going to be? What was the tiebreaker?
But it's only for fun.
Yeah. How many Best Picture winners have there been?
It's 100.
94.
I was close, sir. That was the real quiz. Win!
It wasn't the real quiz. This is your literal fucking day job.
1923 is written down.
I know, bastard.
When was the first Oscars? Was it around then?
94 years ago, I guess.
Okay, yeah.
Like 3 years ago.
Good point. Well played. Well played. All right, then. That is it for this episode. But it's time to look ahead to next week and our next listener suggested pairing as we straddle the very end of January and enter February, Fanny. So, who has the clue, Chris?
I do.
It's you, yeah.
I do. Very excited about next week's films. Can I just say for the record? My clue. It's almost a clue. We're all laughing.
The clue, yeah.
My clue is hiding in Paris. That's
all
hiding in Paris.
Nice.
It's good.
It's really good.
It's very good. Very good. That is your clue for next week's Clash of the Titles, February Fanny, beginning February end. But before then, of course, we are back on Thursday when we're going to be talking Road to Perdition and revealing the winner of this week's Clash. Until then, have a great week.
Clash of the Titles is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Kate Thornton. Join me every week on White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks famous faces three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine.
It's very rare to be introduced with such a thorough introduction, and it's kind of lovely to listen to all that and go, yeah, I've had a good life, right?
You really have.
How did you find that?
I can't even remember.
Yeah, you do your research, Kate, man. I'll tell you that.
Do you know what? You are the only person ever, no other journalist has ever made that connection.
Wow, what a great question.
And receives some truly memorable answers.
And Tom Cruise came, and Nicole Kidman. I go to him, listen, before you go, Tom, I just want you to know, if you fancy a foursome, I'm up for it, and I know Anne-Marie doesn't mind.
When I first dated my now husband, I joined a gym for, I'm going to say, £1,000 a year, just so I could go off and have a poo.
I actually got heckled once in Wales, and there was a bloke at the bar on crutches, and he actually said to me, I'd rather fall over than listen to this shit, and he threw his crutches at me and fell over. Can you believe that?
I've got some cat's ashes, I don't know who they are.
You've been catfished by your own cat.
Exactly, seriously, man.
Dad, have you thought about putting in a breakfast nook? And my dad was thinking of that. Have you thought about getting your own fucking house?
How did you give a duck an orgasm, Craig?
It's good with them, you know. I know my way around a duck.
So, if you fancy a sit-down with the likes of Adam Hills, Tom Allen, Hannah Waddingham, Phil Tufnell, James Acaster and Ed Gamble, Daisy May Cooper, and tons more, then join me every Tuesday and Friday. Search White Wine Question Time in your podcast app to subscribe and listen now. White Wine Question Time is a Stack production.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.